From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What was once a sci-fi fantasy is closer than many of us might have thought. Human gene editing, a technique called CRISPR, has revolutionized scientists' ability to make precise changes in DNA, to actually edit out genes, stop diseases, disabilities in people before they're born. It's prompted a big fight over patents worth billions of dollars, and just last week, an ethics panel gave an okay on research. But critics say not so fast because of ethical concerns about the prospect of engineering bigger, smarter humans and designer babies. This hour on Point, CRISPR, the future and ethics of human gene editing. You can join us on air or online. Have you been following the story of CRISPR and the debate over human gene editing? Are you concerned, worried, freaked out, or optimistic? Joining us now from Washington is Joel Achenbach. He's a science reporter at the Washington Post. And Joel, welcome to On Point. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. And I want to make sure that all of our listeners really understand what we're talking about. So can you give us a sort of basic tutorial on what is CRISPR?
Well, this is a really big deal because, you know, your listeners probably know that in 1953, we figured out, Crick and Watson and Rosalind Franklin figured out the structure of DNA. And then in around 2000, there was the Human Genome Project, you know, studying, you know, what the human genome looks like, you know, these several million in nucleotides lined up and gives you the code of life. What's happened now, and this has been building for four decades, but the big leap forward is CRISPR, which is a way of editing a genome. It doesn't have to be a human. It could be a plant. It could be anything. It leverages a natural system that bacteria developed through evolution over the last billion years. The bacteria have a defense mechanism against viruses that invade the cell and implant sort of an invasive string of genetic material. The bacteria's defense mechanism can snip that away. So a couple of many scientists have worked on studying this natural system. And then in 2012, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, a couple of researchers, one in Berkeley, I think one was at the University of Vienna at the time, or she's moved around, but they figured out how to leverage this natural system as a laboratory tool. So now you can go in the laboratory and you can start editing a genome. You can cut out things that you don't think you want to have in there, and potentially you can add material, though that part of it is trickier.
It's really amazing, Joel, and you call it a big deal. I've read it as described as one of the greatest life science inventions ever. What's the potential? What's the big hope where this could take us?
The key thing about CRISPR is that it's easier and it's cheaper than previous techniques of genetic engineering. And this is not some of your listeners know, this is not the first time people have talked about genetic engineering. It goes back to the 70s. But suddenly it's much more doable. Anyone with a relatively decent lab can learn how to use this mechanism. So it's going to be much more widespread, it's quicker. It's not perfected. I mean, people should understand, no one right now is engineering babies at the moment. No one is. I don't think. I think in China there's been some very limited clinical trials using this technique, but we're still at the beginning of how it's being applied. In the near term, though, this is probably going to be used to develop new crops. It will certainly be used to study diagnostically how cancers form in human beings, because laboratory animals. Because you can figure out, okay, so what's the association between this tumor and the genetic basis for it? It's a very handy diagnostic tool. And so what the story we did last week was about this big ethics report that essentially said, don't use this on the human germline, i.e., you know, eggs and sperm and embryos, except in very, very special, narrow circumstances to prevent a disease.
And to prevent a disease. This is the report from the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Medicine, correct?
Correct. And this report, it's been a year on it. I thought it was the people that I interviewed for the story I wrote thought it was a very careful, look at a complex system. But everyone did point out that they did not absolutely shut the door on germline editing, which some critics say, hey, you know, that's a slippery slope. Once you start going into the germline, now you are potentially changing the human species. What they said, I should make clear, is they said, if you can identify a gene that you know causes a disease and replace it with a normal common gene already in the human species, that would be, and do it safely, that would be ethical.
I got you.
Because you're not really changing the human species. You're just keeping people from developing something like Huntington's disease or something like that.
So potentially a huge breakthrough in fighting disease and preventing disease. Joel Achenbach, science reporter for The Washington Post, stand by because I want to introduce Dr. Matthew Porteous. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at Stanford University. He uses the CRISPR technique to find ways to treat diseases. He was also on that committee on human gene editing, which released the report last week on the ethics of human gene editing. Matt, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me on.
You're a doctor on the front lines of this amazing and hopeful technology. Tell us where it can take us. Before I talk about specifically what you're doing, what kind of cures are we talking about? What kind of diseases could it potentially stop?
Well, I think that this field is really just at its nascency, and what kind of diseases we might be able to cure is really still unknown. But there are certain diseases, genetic diseases that Joel has mentioned, which are caused by somebody being born with a variant in a gene, and that variant causes the gene and the protein from that gene to malfunction, leading to a disease. And so on a chalkboard, it is quite easy to think about going into a cell and using the CRISPR genome editing technology to change that disease-causing variant back to one that doesn't cause a disease. What is amazing in the last few years is that sort of chalkboard, possibility is now feasible. And so what that opens up is the possibility that we can now provide cures for patients who are born with genetic diseases that have never had cures before. And as Joel mentioned, these can be diseases like Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, myotonic dystrophy, the list goes on and on.
And I was reading yesterday in preparing for this hour that the list does go on, that there's hope down the road that it might be able to be used to cure blindness, to fight cancers. I mean, the list would really go on and on and on with a lot of hopeful applications, right?
Exactly right. And in many ways, the idea, or you could use this for many, many diseases. One of the challenges in the future will be actually if a disease only affects a small number of people, who's going to invest in developing what is still sophisticated and complicated technology around those a disease that might only have tens or hundreds of patients around the world. But in theory, any disease for which we know the genetic basis is amenable to this technology.
And Dr. Porteous, tell me what kinds of research with gene editing are you doing? What are you specifically looking at?
So I'm trained as a pediatric hematologist, and I really got into, which means I treat kids, and I treat kids who have diseases of the blood. And one of the most important diseases of the blood is are diseases that cause the immune system not to work properly, and sometimes called bubble boy diseases, and then diseases in which red blood cells don't work properly, like sickle cell anemia and beta thalassemia. And what we know for the last 40 years is that if we take out blood stem cells from someone who doesn't have those diseases and give those blood stem cells, or what we call hematopoietic stem cells, to somebody who does have the disease, that we can cure them of their disease. We replace their blood system using stem cells that make non-disease blood cells. But that's a complicated process, and it's not easy to find the right donor. It's not easy to do those sort of bone marrow transplants. So the idea is, instead of using someone else's cells, is to use these somatic stem cells, a patient's own somatic stem cells, use the CRISPR genome editing technology to change the disease-causing mutant in these stem cells outside the body, where we can control the process, we can measure the process, we can measure if we've done something we don't want to do, and then give those cells back to the patient and cure their blood disease. And that, we think, is one of the first ways of bringing this sort of curative therapy to patients in a logical fashion. We think it will be a stepping stone to then other diseases and other organs which are less accessible than the blood system is.
It sounds astounding. We're coming up against a break, and Joel Achenbach, I know I have to let you go at the end of this break. We just have a few seconds left, but what are your final thoughts before we say goodbye to you about this amazing technology? What are you thinking about?
The key thing I would add is that because it's relatively easy to do this, even though the National Academy says this is okay, this is not okay, there's going to be a do-it-yourself movement with CRISPR, I believe, in the future. And I think the question is, will it become the Wild West of biotechnology?
Okay, that's a great point. And we're going to examine that, talk about that in the hour ahead. Joel Achenbach, science reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking this hour about the advancing science of human gene editing and the big ethical questions that come along with it. You can join the conversation. Are you worried about the ethics of human gene editing? Concerned about how it may change our society? Or do you hope it will save your children from deadly disease? We're talking to Dr. Matthew Porteous, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Stanford University. And joining me now from San Jose, California, is Jeffrey Kahn. He's Director of Johns Hopkins Institute of Bioethics. Like our guest, Matthew Porteous, Mr. Kahn was also on the Committee on Human Gene Editing, which released its ethics report last week. Jeff, welcome to On Point. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you for having me.
So we mentioned you were on that committee which looked at the ethics. Give us the headline of that report. How do you sum up what the conclusion was?
Well, first I'd say hi, Matt. Good to hear your voice again. We went through a process to respond to a task that was given to us, which was around the appropriate use and oversight of these technologies in humans. So you talked at the top of the hour about all the various applications that could the gene editing could be applied in bacteria and plants and animals. We were focusing on humans. And so we talked about using these techniques in ways to cure genetic disease in living existing people, and said the oversight processes that are in place are adequate. So it looks like just a much more precise and much better technique to do what's already done in so-called gene therapy or gene transfer. The sort of big headlines were we did, as Joel Achenbach mentioned, say that there were potential situations where a modification prior to somebody being born, so in sperm or egg or ova, to do genetic modification to prevent disease in that future person. But in the process, that would create a heritable genetic change, so-called germline modification. I will say that the criteria that we listed were very strict, and there were a lot of them. There were 10. And so that's, I think, one big headline. Germline modification, I wouldn't say really an opening of the door, but more a kind of knock on a locked door. Hmm. We can talk more about that if you like. And then the other big headline was we said no to use of these technologies to not only cure disease or prevent disease, but no to enhancement. We said acceptable to prevent disease, acceptable to cure disease, maybe acceptable to prevent disease in future offspring, but no to using these techniques to create enhancements in humans, either future or existing.
Really, really interesting. There's so much in there that I want to explore with you, but we've got a lot of listeners on the line. We're talking about the ethics, the future of gene editing, and CRISPR in particular. Call us with your question. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Easton, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello, and thank you very much. I would like to say, it hits me kind of personally. My mother and her aunt both died of breast cancer. My sister had bone cancer at the same time as my mother having breast cancer. She's fine now. And my father died of liver disease, and his father as well, as well as his sister. A little bit of a difficult subject. But genes are a funny thing. They don't always affect you, but they're there. And if we can find a way to move past that and maybe eliminate some of these problems before they happen, I don't see that as scary at all. I see that as the next step.
See it as the next step. Matthew Porteous, I'd love to bring you back in. Respond to Richard's point. My guess is you would agree with him.
Well, as an MD, of course, one of my primary focuses is to focus on the patient in front of me and provide the best available care for that patient. And that drives what many of us in medicine and research are trying to do. But what we want to make sure is that, and so I appreciate Richard's positive words, and those are the words that drive a lot of us and motivate a lot of us. But we want to make sure that in the process of providing the best care to both treat and prevent disease, that we're not violating norms outside, you know, the societal norms. And that's part of why the committee also emphasized the need for broad discussion. And so I think that's part of what we're doing, is to say we're no longer in an era where scientists and MDs can work in a bubble that is isolated from the way, from the rest of society. And instead, we're part of society, and what we do both reflects and contributes to how our society functions. But curing disease, minimizing suffering are key principles that drive me and many of my colleagues.
Let's go to Darren, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Darren, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Thank you so much for taking my call today. I'm actually going back to school right now to be a biomedical engineer, and just because of how excited I've been about the recent developments with CRISPR. I wanted to just make a clarification. In your intro, you really made this breakthrough with CRISPR sound like it was having mainly to do with editing future babies and making designer babies, but with the breakthroughs and with a little bit more growth in the industry, we're going to be talking about live editing your own personal DNA, not the DNA of your offspring. The implications for that are very large. The way that people are talking about doing this is by creating a man-made virus that'll target specific areas of your DNA and go in and make changes. And they're talking about using this technique for curing cancers fixing genetic disabilities. But the implications of this technique are no less scary than the development of the nuclear bomb, because we're talking about the ability to create a virus that could target any specific type of person throughout the world. And it's with that, we're going to have to develop this technology just to counteract the technology being developed in other parts of the world. Just like the nuclear arms race progressed, we'll have to think of alternative ways to stop the negative uses of this technology from happening. And I worry that a future with little oversight in the industry and how cheap this technique is allowing genetic engineering to become, I worry about the sustainability of our planet. I feel like it's just one more big thing hanging over the human race.
Well, Darren, you've put a lot on the table there, and I'd love to get both Dr. Matthew Porteous and Jeffrey Kahn to respond to that. Thanks for the call. Jeffrey, let me come to you with some of those points that Darren made, I mean, particularly about this sort of equating this to controlling the potential of this as if we have to, you know, be careful with the development of a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that particular imagery and the metaphor, but certainly the international control is an important question. And the committee that Matt and I were members of were, as you said at the top of the hour, was sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Medicine in the U.S., but partnering with the Royal Society in the U.K. and the Chinese Academy of Sciences. I say that because part of the task of this committee was to identify international principles, or principles that could apply internationally, to work towards what we might think of as norms within the science that would cross borders. So clearly you can't make laws in the U.S. that would apply in other countries, but you certainly can identify principles, and we did, seven principles that we thought ought to be applied across any country that was wanting to engage in the use of this science and create regulations and oversight for it. So make regulations that make sense within your society as long as they live within this umbrella, if you will, of seven principles as a way of making sure that we do have some consistency of behavior across international boundaries. And to just say two more words about that, the release of this report was on February the 14th, and on that day it was announced that there would be a set of conferences, workshop symposia, first in Beijing and then in London or somewhere else in the UK, to talk about how those principles and this approach that got articulated in the report from the National Academies might be modified or applied in these other international contexts. So I think we're moving towards a discussion that speaks to some of the issues that Darren was raising in his comments.
Jeffrey, I wanted to follow up with you about the report that came out last week and the concerns about gene editing on the human germline, which could make changes that would essentially persist in sperm or eggs and could be passed down to future generations. I mean, it just sounds like such a mind-boggling minefield of potential and also concerns. You said, you used the term, you didn't sort of give the green light and open the door, but you sort of knocked on a locked door. Can you sort of explain that a little bit more about the sort of complications around that, the idea of editing the human germline and what the report really said last week about that?
Sure. So maybe just to pick up on what Matt said earlier. So one way to approach the use of gene editing is to take cells in existing living people and modify them. That would be somatic cell modification. So those changes die with the person who's been changed. And we have been trying to do that for probably the last 30 or 35 years using different techniques. So CRISPR and other gene editing technologies make that easier, more precise, better, cheaper, faster. But that's something we know how to think about in terms of the ethics and the oversight. What has not been permitted up till now, really anywhere in the world, is modifications that persist into the offspring of the person who's been modified and therefore into future generations, right? That would happen in perpetuity. And so that's been a prohibition. And the oversight body in the United States that must review and make recommendations about going forward with the use of gene modification techniques is called the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, or the RAC, R-A-C. It's an NIH committee. I served on it. Matt has also served on it. The prohibition at the RAC is you cannot propose anything that will change a genome such that that change can be inherited by future generations. So there's literally a prohibition. That's the locked door. The committee said there may be situations in the future. We need a lot more information about how these technologies work in preclinical uses. That means animal models. And we need more information on how they work in somatic applications, so in people who are currently existing and would die with the changes that were introduced, before we even think about making modifications that would be passed on. But in some circumstances, when there's literally no other way for a couple to have a genetically related child except that they will pass on a very devastating genetic disease, think of Huntington's disease as an example, then you might think about modifying sperm or egg, or maybe embryo, easier to modify sperm or egg, and then prevent that disease from being in the child that would be created by the in vitro fertilization involving that egg or that sperm. All right, and that would mean that change would be passed on into that that child's offspring into the future, but you're reverting them back to what would be naturally occurring, the non-disease state. And so we said in cases like that, it was possible to think about going forward, but only with much more public discussion, as Matt said earlier, with much more scientific information and with lots of oversight, including long-term follow-up of individuals to make sure that they would be healthy and such, and they would pass on healthy genes to the future offspring. I would say one more thing, and then I'll stop, which is to say this committee said we're not talking about designing babies. We're talking about helping people have healthy babies.
Got it. And I'd like to introduce George Annis. He's director of the
Anthony, this is Matt Portes. Can I just add one thing to what Jeff said?
Yeah. Let me just finish my introduction of George Annis, and then absolutely I'll come right back to you, Matt. George Annis is director of the Center for Health Law, Ethics, and Human Rights at Boston University. He's a professor of health law, and he's got a lot to say about the ethics of all of this. George Annis, it's good to have you on point.
Good to be here.
Now, if you can just stand by, because I want to give Matthew Portes a chance
to
respond there. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, this will be really quick. And just building on what the caller, Darren, mentioned and what Jeff said, which is that I think a risk in the U.S. right now is we don't want to drive this process underground, and that prohibitions on the RAC and the FDA to evaluate different genome editing procedures has a risk that it drives it underground. And I think we need to make sure that that what people are doing is transparent and open, and not done in a way where people are doing it in a way that we don't understand. And in fact, I think the Chinese researchers who did some research on human non-viable zygotes exemplify this. They did not try to keep it hidden. They published the results and they reported the results so that the world could evaluate and criticize and discuss. And I think we need to make sure that we create a structure that allows that openness to continue. I'll end there.
Okay, I appreciate that. George Annis, let me bring you into this conversation and jump in any way you like. But I mean, as an ethicist, as someone who looks at this as an ethicist, what are your concerns? What are your thoughts?
Well, the first one is, how do you frame this? I mean, we've heard Darren frame it as like a nuclear bomb or a bioweapons virus, and then we've heard the committee framed it as, well, we'll just look at the 5 or 10 people in the world who can't have a genetically related child if they're afflicted by a serious genetic disease that would necessarily be passed on. I really think that is misleading. I think it's much more than that. I think we are talking about designer babies. Even though I like Jeffrey's statement, it's a knock on a locked door. I think the press has read it. It's an open door. Come on in and try to do this. Try to have better babies. I mean, virtually no one argues that we shouldn't use the CRISPR technique to try to cure diseases from people who exist. The controversial part is, should we use it on, quote, people who will exist in the future who don't exist now? And, you know, I think the burden of proof should really be on those people who want to try to use it on embryos and sperm for future generations, that there's any good reason to do that.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about this hour about human gene editing. You can join the conversation. Do you support editing our genes? We're talking to Dr. Matthew Portes, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Stanford University, Jeffrey Kahn, Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute of Bioethics, and George Annis, Director of the Center for Health Law, Ethics, and Human Rights at Boston University. I want to go to some of the calls very quickly, but here are a couple of comments from our Facebook page. Bob Terrell writes, as with most things, there isn't a clear-cut answer. It's simple to deal in absolutes. It's easy to declare that editing people is unethical. But if someone inherits a genetic disease through no fault of their own, is it ethical not to heal them? Michael Alcott writes, 110% for this. Could there be some bad results? Sure. However, human reproduction, as it has happened for all of our history, has and still does produce some pretty awful results, too. Jeffrey Kahn, I want to come back to you before the break. We heard from George Annis, who really said straight out that we are talking about modifying future beings. This really does have the potential. This really is about designer babies, and we sort of have to own up to that and face that. What do you say to that?
Hi, George, first. But I would say I agree with him that in the last comment he made, which was it's an obligation on those who want to use it to justify its use. And that's exactly what the committee said. We said, you know, don't rush forward here, but rather if criteria can be met, and they're very, very stringent, and much information will need to be collected before anybody can even propose to go forward in genetic modification of people that will be inherited. Right? That I think that we're actually on the same page about whether it's acceptable to go forward and for what purposes. So there'll need to be much discussion, and not just among the scientific community or the oversight bodies that are in place, but with the public. And that's a point that Matt made, and I'll reinforce. The committee was really clear. Public engagement is a critical part of this discussion. So the societies in which this technology will be implemented need to weigh in. And there are great examples, mostly coming out of the United Kingdom, of using practiced and lots of experience in public engagement to discuss ethically charged technologies as a way of finding out what the public thinks. So it cannot go forward in this country or probably any other without a significant amount of additional information, time, and engagement of the public.
Professor Annis, are you comfortable with what the National Advisory Panel had to say about this? I mean, the conclusion.
Well, I think that the point Jeffrey made is absolutely right, that you need the public, more than participation, though. In December, when this started, December 2015, the meeting in Washington concluded that it would be irresponsible to proceed with this unless there is a broad societal consensus about its appropriateness. The new report says that what you need is broad, ongoing participation and input by the public. That's a lot weaker. So you can see how it may look to some people, including me, that the public participation part has been watered down and really doesn't seem all that important, or as important as it did just 2 years ago.
I want to spend the rest of the hour really hearing from our callers. We've got a lot of them lined up. So let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. An issue with human germline editing, which is concerning, is that it could just increase the social divide between the affluent who can afford it and the poor who could not afford it and could be continuing to pass on mutations to the next generation. Sickle cell disease would be a great example of that.
Jim, it's a really interesting and important question. George Annis, is that something that that you think about when you think about this issue?
I think about it, but it gets us way ahead of our question, should we do it at all? The question he's asking, if we do it, should everybody do it? Should we all do it? And, or should it be available to everyone? And knowing it won't be, we can't even give health insurance to more than 20 million people in this country to do routine medical things. The idea that there's not going to be some class and wealth divide with germline genetics is fanciful, I think.
Yeah. Matthew Porteous, I'd love to get you to respond to our caller on that one.
Yeah, 2 points. One is that one of the things about that the committee said about germline editing is that only if there was not a reasonable alternative. And what I think for a disease like sickle cell is that there will be a reasonable alternative, and that will be somatic cell editing. And so that's really incumbent on us who are trying to develop somatic cell editing to make it as good as possible so that the need reduce the number of potential people in the world. I'll disagree with Professor Annis that it's only 5 to 10 people, but from a small number of people to even a smaller number of people by making somatic cell editing better and better and safer and safer. The other thing is of course, the committee absolutely talked a lot about the issue of fairness and equity, and it's one of the key principles that the document includes, that we shouldn't develop, or we should try to avoid developing something that increases inequality and decreases fairness in the world. And so that is an important principle that we wanted to make sure we conveyed.
Let's go to Adam, who's calling from Maynard, Massachusetts. Adam, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Anthony. I'm the father of three boys, including my youngest, who has Angelman syndrome. It's a single gene genetic disorder, a neurogenetic disorder that impacts his development. He can't speak. He has mobility issues. And I will likely be taking care of him for the rest of his life unless technologies and therapies come online. Now, the Angelman community is working very hard on this, and we are working with some of the pioneers in this area to work on gene replacement therapy, somatic cell, work on neurons in the brain. But my takeaway here, I obviously have skin in this game.
Yes, obviously.
I know a lot of people in the rare disease community. We need these technologies so that we can repair the work that, you know, we can repair the genes and prevent human suffering on a large scale. We really need to evaluate how these technologies can heal and reduce human suffering in a meaningful way for thousands of genetic conditions like SMA and RAIS. There are so many diseases that the National Organization of Rare Diseases has information on. There are single gene diseases, so probably easy to fix in the scope of, you know, our evolution as a species. We can get this done, and I think we need to get this done.
Adam, I hear your passion, and I understand why, and I wish you and your son so much good luck. Jeffrey Kahn, I'd love you to speak to Adam's point. I mean, there's a dad talking about, real hope for a beloved member of his family.
Right, and I wish you well too, Adam. I would say that what Adam is talking about as somatic cell therapy, which is working on using genetic gene editing tools on existing people who are sick and trying to cure them, to remove the thing that's causing them to be sick. And we have been trying to do that. The scientific community, people like Matt, have been trying to do that for decades. It's just very challenging to do. And so these new gene editing tools like CRISPR offer real hope for moving forward in doing what has so far been elusive. And so I would say, you know, hang in there, hopefully in time for your child, but you know, if not for him, then for future generations. And that's what this report is trying to lay out, how to go forward in a way that will allow the benefits of these technologies to be realized in humans without going down the path of unethical behavior.
George Annis, a moment ago, you sort of raised the question of whether or not we should be going forward with germline editing at all. Can you expand on that? I mean, do you think that it's possible to even imagine that this couldn't go forward? I mean, it sort of feels like the genie is out of the bottle. Isn't this, aren't we going to move forward?
It's possible for me to imagine that. The committee said over and over again that, you know, you're never going to get every country in the world to agree with it, so we shouldn't prohibit it. The fact that you're not going to give every country in the world to agree doesn't mean you shouldn't prohibit something any more than we prohibit, torture or murder. I mean, so the first question is not, is it going to be done necessarily, but should it be done? Should it be done? And it seems to me there's still widespread consensus that it shouldn't be done. Even the committee won't say that. I don't expect any science committee ever to say there's some research you shouldn't do. On the other hand, we're getting close here to saying that. One of the funders of this study, as you probably know, was DARPA. And DARPA's in this only for national security, so they have to believe something good can happen to our soldiers or that they can develop a defense to bioweapons by using CRISPR. I don't think that's irrelevant. I think it's wrong to just concentrate on a small number of couples who can't have a genetically related child without a genetic problem. That's an issue, but it's a tiny issue compared to new novel viruses, gene drives, how the technology can be used actually on the international stage to affect alliances, wars, et cetera.
Let's go to Jim. Anthony? Yes, go ahead. Is that Jeffrey?
This is Jeff. This is Jeff Kahn. I would love to just say one thing in response to George's comment, which is
Please do, Jeff.
Committee did say that many things should not be done. We said it's that genetic modification in heritable context should not be done in the vast majority of cases and examples. We said that gene editing should not be done in ways that lead to enhancements in humans. So we really did try to draw lines that would cabin off a very small proportion, a very limited number of examples of modification of the germline. And in the process,
you
identified
did.
Many things that should
right.
not be you're allowed.
George, you're,
right.
you're acknowledging.
Enhancement,
yeah, go ahead.
As you know, is defining what's the difference between an enhancement and a disease cure. Right?
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out the potential for biological warfare. Everyone's talking about designer babies and designer humans and designer animals. Well, why not designer viruses or designer bacteria? You could simply edit the ability for something to incubate or to make it more or less contagious than it was before, and then you would have an outbreak on something on a level that we've never seen before. Something like the smallpox virus, for example, if you edited how contagious it was or its incubation period, and then released it on a population, you're talking about, you know, a pandemic on a scale that's unthinkable.
Well, Jim, it's a frightening thought. Earlier in the hour, we had a caller sort of equating this to nuclear technology and the hopefulness of that and the huge destructive potential that it brings. But who wants to tackle Jim's unsettling question?
Well, he's correct. I mean, Bill Gates...
George Annis.
Bill Gates made what now is 2 days ago a very famous statement, worrying about exactly that same thing, either a naturally occurring epidemic or even scarier, a genetically engineered virus that we wouldn't have a defense against. So, yeah, I mean, it may seem like a totally different question, and in some case sense it is, but with the do-it-yourself prospect that one of the callers mentioned, that's something I think we really, really do have to worry about, and hopefully people are worried about it in the right places.
Jeffrey Kahn, did that concern come up among the folks on the National Advisory Panel?
No, but only because the task to our committee was not related to gene drive or genetic modification of pathogens. It was gene editing technologies used in humans. That said, other committees of the national academies and international committees have and are taking on these questions. They're absolutely critical for discussion. And I would add things like genetic modification of mosquitoes in an attempt to prevent vector-borne disease. But using gene drive, which allows a genetic modification to be passed on very quickly into a large population of an organism, you can really get modification of large numbers of species pretty quickly. No one's talking about doing that in humans, but we do need to be thinking about what if some rogue state decided that was an appropriate thing to do.
Let's try to take one more call before this hour is up. Shane is calling from Toland, Connecticut. Shane, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. I hear both sides of it. As a parent, you know, I would hate to have a child born with some disease that I know that possibly could be cured with this technology. But just because the committee states things that shouldn't be done doesn't mean that future generations won't use or lift these limitations and use them in ways that, you know, we don't intend them to be right now. You know, I think you're opening a Pandora's box with this. And I also think that just because you can do something, it doesn't mean that you should do something.
All right, Shane, we hear you. George Annis, we're up against the clock. Respond sort of finally to Shane's comment.
No, I think Shane really hit the nail on the head. You know, we can't just do a cost-benefit analysis because we always think the benefits in medicine are going to be great and we're going to be able to live with or control the costs and the risks. But we're getting to the point now where we're engaged in such novel work that we really can't anticipate the downside.
And Jeffrey Kahn, literally 15 seconds left. I want to give the final word to you as someone who was on that, sat on that panel.
I think we recognize that this needed to be an ongoing conversation and made that very clear in our recommendation. So I hope that that will be the case.
Jeffrey Kahn, director of the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for joining us. Really important discussion. I really appreciated your input.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
And George Annis, director of the Center for Health Law, Ethics, and Human Rights at Boston University. Thank you, Professor Annis.
Thank you again.
And Dr. Matthew Porteous, associate professor of pediatrics at Stanford University. Great to have you on the program as well.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.